to Marion, Iowa. So like 3 days ago. So our house is full of boxes. Finding socks this morning was a challenge. So I've got six kids, three boys and three girls. We homeschool them. My oldest is 18. My youngest is 8. That's probably the most exciting part about me, my kids. So, I'm from Believer Stewardship Services, headquartered in Dubuque, and I've been there for almost 20 years. And my role there is I'm the chief investment officer. So I'm in charge of all the monies. We have endowments of our own, some planned giving things that I'll tell you about. And then we also manage money for other institutions and do some financial planning for individuals. So anything I'm missing about myself? I don't think so. I'll just commence. Common verse, you know, 1 Corinthians, let a man so consider us servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. And we like to point out that it's not suggested that stewards be found faithful, or it's not a good idea. It's required for stewards to be faithful. And you know the context of this verse is the gospel. Paul was staking his joy and his credibility and his reputation that he was a steward of the gospel. That's what he put himself forward as. And we are, if you're a believer, you're a steward of the gospel. And if you're a steward of one, it should affect how you talk and how you think, how you view the world. It should affect everything you do, including how you handle your possessions, how you handle your money. And that's, I want to start out just talking about that in the context of us as believers, stewards of the mysteries of God. Paul wanted to be regarded in that manner. It's a good desire to want to be regarded in that manner, no matter what you do for a vocation or where you're at, to be regarded as a steward of the mysteries of God. How does one of these stewards handle money? How do you handle possessions? Do you give it all away? I want to just read you one of the most unpopular passages in the Bible. It's Luke 14:25, and I'll read it to you. I didn't put it up. You can just listen. It says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So then, none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. So, what does it mean? None of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. I don't know if you've read, William MacDonald has a little book called True Discipleship, and he says in it, what it actually means is, none of you can be my disciple unless you give up all your own possessions. He says it means exactly what it says. If you follow through the passage and specifically look at the examples the Lord uses, I think it adds a lot of light to what's going on here. And specifically, he gives two examples, and one is building a building. When you build a building, when you start out, do you have to have all the supplies? And the answer is you don't when you start digging, but you need to be mindful if you're building a tower. If you want to build it to the sky, you need a plan to have supplies to build it all the way up. And there needs to be a recognition of what it's going to cost in the end. And the same thing with battle. You can declare war and not have more soldiers than the other person, but you better have a plan if you're going to conquer, of how you're going to defeat that army, in the end, you need to know. And I think what the Lord's saying here, do you have to give it all up at the beginning? And I don't think you do. But at the end, there needs to be a recognition. There needs to be a recognition at the end. That's what it will cost. And that follows soon the life of Abraham. Abraham didn't have to give it all up at the beginning, just had to leave Ur. But in the end, he did have to give it up. He had to give his son. And if we're going to go the distance with King Jesus, we need to be on the road to surrender it all. And I think that's what's going on in this passage. So if we don't, if we're not on that journey to surrender it all, I think this passage says we'll be put to shame. So I want to give you, just in the context of that, of giving it up, and in the context of being a steward, some encouragement on giving before we start. And you remember in Exodus, early on, when Moses tells all the people to bring a contribution for the tabernacle. He says, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution." After people gave mountains of things to the Lord, they had so much. You know the story. Moses said, "Tell the people to stop." And I want you to picture that. If you having a gift to bring and you want to be part of the story, you want to be part of it, and you bring it and you find out it's too late. The disappointment that would be to be restrained from giving. The New Testament doesn't put any restraints on giving, which is noteworthy because the champions of giving in the New Testament aren't rich people. They're dirt poor. The widow and the Macedonians, they didn't wait till they had a surplus to give. They gave out of their poverty, the Macedonians. The widow gave her last mite. If you wait till you have a surplus to be a champion giver, you're probably not. You can be a champion with very modest assets. I'd encourage you to give now. A couple years ago, actually like 15 years ago, I knew a student. He was in Dubuque, and he had a remarkable story. He was a refugee from Nigeria, and he ended up on the Ivory Coast in a refugee camp. And just by no explanation other than just the finger of God, he ended up in America. Somebody sent him a plane ticket. It was before 9/11, so somehow he was able to get through security at the airport. And he literally showed up with a plastic bag with an extra shirt in it, slippers for shoes, and really nothing. And he ended up at the front door of this college. And I knew the guy. He was just an unusually pleasant guy. And I always intended to like give him 10 or 30 bucks because I knew he didn't have anything. But I just, you know, never got around to it. And about 8 years later, he stopped by my office, and he had finished his undergraduate degree. And because he would kind of fit into a quota system, black guy from Nigeria, the educational systems loved him because they're trained to get minorities in the programs. He finished an MBA. He went on to get a PhD. And when he stopped by my office, he was working for Bank of America doing corporate mergers. And when he left, I thought, I had lost my opportunity to give him 20 bucks. I could have been part of his story, or part of the story, just a small part of where he was going, and I lost out. And I'd encourage you to give while you have the chance. God's telling a story, and it's a story about his son, Jesus Christ. One man's going to shine. And through giving, we can be part of that story. And our opportunity to give is going to draw to a close eventually. So do your giving. So Believer Stewardship Services. We assist believers, just like you, with just issues regarding stewardship. And it's as simple as that and as complicated as that. Believer Stewardship Services, you probably, Rob might have given you a synopsis Sunday, but It started as an outgrowth of a ministry of Emmaus Bible College about 20 years ago. And about 15 years ago, we became our own organization. We have our own board, our own tax-exempt status, legal distinct entity. We want to encourage, enable, and exhort believers to be good stewards. So we have an attorney on staff. We've got a CPA. I'm a CFP. And we've got a bunch of other guys that just have a load of experience in financial matters. And this slide, I ran this off on Monday. This is the U.S. debt clock, the outstanding public debt as of June 20th. How are we doing as Americans as stewards? And by this statistic, we're not doing very well. Doesn't take an astute statistician to see we have got some issues. Some may see this as just the greed and failure of Wall Street, or some may see it as a welfare system out of control, or issues in Washington, D.C., where they're just not willing to deal with problems. I'd like to suggest the issue here is it's a moral failure at every level. The remarkable thing about a startling number like this is we live, as you know, in the richest country in the world. No people have ever lived like we have lived as far as wealth and quality of life. The rest of the world doesn't hold a candle to us. China, for all its fanfare of growth, is like a fourth the size of us, GDP, and we have 25% of the people as China. A nation with this kind of abundance, with a debt climbing like this, it's nonsensical, it's non-intuitive, but it's the judgment of the Lord. And there's not a lot we can do, believer stewardship services, to influence Congress, but we do want to make a big impact with believers to be good stewards for the Lord. And how do we do that? There are we do it really four ways. We do it with helping people with estate planning, with planned giving. We are a support for ministries, and we also offer investment counsel. So as you've probably heard, we're in the midst of the assets transferring from a World War II and after generation to a next generation after that. And it's known as this wealth transfer. And some reports it's up to $59 trillion is transferring from one generation to another. A lot of wealth is being transferred, and money's being put in the laps of these post-World War II generation people. As that money transfers, we want to help funnel some of that money to the Lord's work all over the world and make a big impact. So, and estate planning is one of the ways we do that. How do we help with estate planning? And what time do you guys usually stop? Sorry, is it 8 o'clock or 8:30?
We'll leave the building at 8:30.
Okay, gotcha. So estate planning. Early on, I was helping an old guy with some estate planning, and he was really upset. The estate of his mother and father, his sister had taken something from the estate. I can't even remember what it was, and he was angry about it. And the thing that startled me was his sister had been dead for 15 years, and it was a lesson to me that having an estate plan that's put together is not only good stewardship before the Lord, it's a good gift to your kids. To have an estate plan without a lot of fighting and a lot of contention can put your family in a good situation by having all your documents together. What are those documents? We usually help people with five documents. First, just a last will and testament. You guys are probably familiar with that. Most people, I could take a show of hands, and if this was representative of the United States, over 50% of you wouldn't have a last will and testament. I read a story about a judge in North Carolina who died who didn't have a last will and testament. A judge. If you die without a will, your estate goes through something called intestacy, and just the laws of the universal probate court, it passes through that way, and usually it's not the way most people would want it. Last will and testament can correct that. The other thing a last will and testament does, if you have minor children, you can nominate a guardian in your last will and testament for minor children. A will is instructions to a probate court judge. So when you die, things are titled in your name, and as you go through the probate process, a judge will take control of your assets. He'll give something called letters of administration to a personal representative, an executor, and they can do the job of transferring your assets over. Usually it's about 2-3% of your estate. You do go through the court system. It's a probate court judge. Courts aren't that fun even when you haven't done anything illegal. So most people try to avoid probate. Has anybody taken their parents' assets through probate or been through probate? No. Not a lot of fun. You can't avoid dying, but there are ways to avoid probate. And there's things like you can put people on as a joint owner on an account. You can put transfer on death on an account, so when you die, the assets transfer immediately. Those things are often called poor man's estate planning. They can work real well. Sometimes they don't work well at all when people die out of the wrong order or somebody declares bankruptcy or people get a divorce. One of the best ways to avoid the probate process is something called a revocable living trust. So has anybody heard the term revocable living trust? Yeah, good. Has anybody ever seen a revocable living trust? Yeah, good. We saw one going down the street on the back of a pickup bed the other day, and we had an artist draw a picture of it. And here's what the revocable living trust looked like. It looked like this. So one of the best ways to think about a revocable living trust is to think about ownership. And this diagram kind of, my dad's kind of an artist, and he drew this for me, and Chloe colored it for me this afternoon. So how do you think about a trust? And it's in terms of ownership. When you say you own something, what do you mean? Well, you own it if you earned it. And so a trust is its own legal entity. So this guy on the top dumping money into this contraption my dad drew as a trust, he's the grantor. He earned it, and he's putting the money into the trust. How else do you own things? You own it if you're responsible for it. So that's the trustee. That's this fellow doing the controls down here. The trustee legally owns it. He's responsible. He has to take care of it. The other way you think about ownership is a beneficiary. This is this guy down here. He gets to enjoy it. And the good part about a revocable living trust is you're all three. You earned it, you put it into the trust, you control it, you're responsible for it, and you get a benefit from it. And so those are kind of the forms of ownership. The good part about a revocable living trust is this guy down here controlling it, which is you, when you become incapacitated or die, you can nominate a successor trustee to come in and work the controls for you or manage your assets, give them away, pay your bills, things like that. Revocable living trust. So what other documents do you need? I'm going to go back. So last will and testament. You still have a last will and testament even if you have a revocable living trust. If you have a trust, the trust has to own everything. So you don't own your house or bank accounts or brokerage accounts. The trust owns it all. But if you happen to own something in your name when you die, that will still have to go through probate. So you still need a last will and testament. We call it a pour-over will. It pours over things over into the revocable living trust so they can be managed by the successor trustee. You also need a power of attorney. Power of attorney is just a letter from you letting someone else act on your behalf. They can be very narrow. You can have a power of attorney to let someone manage land affairs for you. Or it can be a general power of attorney that's broad, to give somebody broad powers to do whatever they need to do on your behalf. Power of attorney. Another document you need is a living will, advanced medical directive. So usually those two documents go together, the power of attorney for healthcare. That nominates someone else to make health decisions for you when you're not able to. And it usually goes together with a living will. That's stating how much care you want at the end of life. If you want it, if you're incapacitated, in the opinion of two doctors, you won't recover. This living will instructs your agent that you nominate to pull the plug or let you pass away. Very tough decisions. To just have the medical power of attorney, their job is really to enforce your living will, enforce your wishes. Nelson Mandela, I'm sure you've heard of him. He didn't have one of these, and he remained on life support for months. The doctors kept telling his family the guy needs to die, and they didn't have the fortitude to do it. It's good to have those. You've heard of Terry Schiavo. It's good to have this in order. Tough decisions to make. I've been there. Maybe you have too. But even when a person is on life support and no chance of recovery, it's still a very difficult decision. It's final. So good to have those things in order. So estate planning. Estate planning is one of those things that's very easy to put off, and you can start with your folder right here in front of you. So we offer estate planning, it's no charge, we offer it for free. So if you open up your packet, inside you'll find behind the left-hand pocket, there's something called a personal financial organizer. And it's all the information you know. And usually the first step is just the hardest, putting your name on the page. So I'd encourage you right now to write your name down, his legal name, her legal name, and start filling it out. It's going to go through and solicit from you all the things that you need to know that will help us put together an estate plan. So send this to us, and we can start moving forward. What do we do from here? You send the personal financial organizer to us. We prepare a document called Instructions to Lawyer, which really just summarizes it. We make sure we've got it right, and then we move on to drafting the document. So I'd encourage each one to do that. The instructions on the back for who you want to name as agent for your medical power of attorney. Did everybody write their name on it yet? So that's kind of breezing through estate planning. So I'm going to go on to planned giving. If I put you to sleep, you can wake back up again. We're going to talk about planned giving. We're going to start fresh. What is planned giving? Instead of giving a dollar today, planned giving is planning to give a dollar in the future. And lots of times by using planned gifts, you can make big gifts. People often tell us, you know, our estate is modest, we wish we could give more. Lots of times through planned giving, you can give a lot more. You can make a really big impact. How can you do that? First is a donor advised fund. How many people have heard of a donor advised fund? Okay. Great. Donor advised fund, it's kind of like your own private foundation, if you've ever heard of that. You give a gift, and it's a gift to Believer Stewardship Services. No charge for this. It goes into an account, and you can name it whatever you want, the Tickey Family Fund or the Wells Kaup Family Fund. It stays in that fund, and you can make suggestions, and we make gifts to charitable organizations or assemblies or wherever you want it to go out of that fund. Why would you use a donor advised fund and not just make the check out directly to the organization? There's a couple of benefits of a donor advised fund. One is just simply if you're coming up to the end of the year and you want an income tax deduction, for the year you're in, and it's December 28th, and you don't have time to make checks out to 10 places, or you don't know where you want it to go, you can just plop it in a donor advised fund, get an income tax deduction for the current year, and then pay it out over the next year if you want to. One other really great way to use a donor advised fund is the best, one of the best ways to give is to use appreciated assets, assets that you bought for a low price and have gone up in value. It's great to do it because when you give something like that, you get a deduction for the full amount, you get an income tax deduction for what it's worth, but you don't pay tax if you sold it and gave the cash, you'd pay all that capital gains tax. But if you gift the asset, you get the full fair market value, we can sell it and use all the proceeds to benefit wherever you want it to go. And it'd be a real hassle to do that if you had a bunch of places you wanted to benefit, and you'd have to divide it up into shares and give it to places. Wouldn't work very well. But a donor advised fund works great for that. We've had tons of stuff through our donor advised fund, from billboards to a helicopter, all kinds of stuff. But lots of times it's just cash or marketable securities people use it for. Another benefit, you can give anonymously through a donor advised fund. Can't do that if you just make out a check, but you can do that. If you give it to the donor advised fund, we can send it and they don't know who gave it. A lot of people also use the donor advised fund as the charitable portion in their estate from their will or revocable living trust. Works really well that way. If you name the organizations you want to give to in your trust or your will, if the organization drops out of existence or goes off the wall theologically and you want to change it, that would mean amending your revocable living trust or writing a new will. If you just nominate your donor advised fund, you just need to send us a letter and say, forget that place, give that portion to another place instead. So donor advised fund, there's probably other benefits I'm forgetting, but it's... we pass a lot of money through to the Lord's work every year through that. Planned giving. What else do we have? I'm just going to breeze through these. This is a charitable gift annuity and charitable remainder trust. Just the 10,000-foot view. You give a lump of money, or better yet, an appreciated asset. We keep it. From that, those funds, we pay an amount back to you every year, a certain percentage, and when you die, it goes to the Lord's work somewhere. You get an income tax deduction right away the year you give it, and you get a stream of income back during your lifetime, and it works pretty well. And in your packet there, there's a one on charitable gift annuities, and the rates are right inside there. So if you open it up, this is charitable gift annuities. You can have it on a single life or two lives. And so if you just find your age, you can see what a charitable gift annuity would pay out. Just like our donor advised fund, it can go to any organization that you want it to go to. So it's kept in an account, and we invest it, and the amount goes up by the amounts invested, and when it goes down by the amounts we pay out back to you, and when you go home to be with the Lord, the remainder amount goes to the Lord's work somewhere. So the only stipulation is that, of course, the organizations can't be in conflict with our mission. We wouldn't give to the Gay and Lesbian Association, but we've never had an issue with that. So charitable gift annuities. So I'm just going to breeze over, not touch on charitable lead trusts or irrevocable life insurance trusts, but there's lots we can do to make a big impact. You'd think charitable organizations, their big donations would come from the, $10, $20 million estates. It's not true. Organizations benefit just from modest estates, a small percentage, just regular people leaving a small percentage to them. So planned giving. The other thing we do, I'm just going to, again, fly through this, is church and ministry support for Christian organizations and assemblies. We do endowment management. We help with corporate governances. Lots of times an assembly has come to us and they haven't filed their annual report with the Secretary of State since 1972, and we'll often help them straighten it out. Christian organizations, often they have to get a 501c3 status to remain a tax-exempt organization, and the rules have changed regarding that about 5 years ago, and a handful of organizations have lost their status. They're in a heap of trouble. We help them go through that. Tax compliance, we help with that. Dissolution and ministry continuance, that is picked up. When an assembly isn't doing well and they go defunct, what we're able to do is they donate their facility to us, to a donor-advised fund. We liquidate it, invest it for them, and we can keep paying their missionaries or full-time workers with the funds. That's worked really well. So, so now the good part. My part is the financial counsel. I'm the chief investment officer for Believer Stewardship Services and financial counseling. What do we do? All the other things we do, we don't charge for that. This aspect, there's definitive costs that we do pass through to the people we help. So, in the course of helping people with estate planning and planned giving, people would often show us their investments, show us their brokerage statements, and say, you know, how have we done? And lots of times we'd say, oh, not very well. And about 2007, we became a registered investment advisor so we could start helping believers in this way, managing money and doing financial planning. Often we would have run into people who'd just been taken advantage of by a financial salesman, by an insurance guy, just kind of taken advantage of. And it was, when the person had a lot of assets, it was a downer. But when people were already struggling and had really modest means and they'd been taken advantage of, it was really depressing. And so we're able to offer a lot of counsel in this area, and it's been good. Just on that note, what do we do when somebody's in a bad situation, or how do we count? They're in consumer debt up to their eyeballs or whatever. We call out to the Lord with them, and it's wonderful to be a believer in that case and see how the Lord has provided, so, and how he will provide. One of the great things about how we operate in Believer Stewardship Services is we operate as a fiduciary. $5 word, fiduciary. Fiduciary is the highest duty under the law. A fiduciary has to act in the best interest of the person they're helping. If you're a successor trustee, you have a fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the grantor of the trust. As a fiduciary, we are able to sit on the same side of the table as the clients. We don't sell any products. We just give counsel, and it's worked well. So, in everything we do, we want to help people have a big view of God and a big view, help them dream big for the Lord. And how do we do that? A lot of people have misconceptions about money, and often it's misconceptions from their parents or misconceptions growing up, and they carry them into adulthood. And when we do financial planning with somebody, we want to help them work through those issues. How do we do that? Often we start just by asking people, what was money like growing up in your house? I had a gal in my office about 5 months ago, very successful, a lot of assets, and we worked through her earliest memory of money was her dad gave her $5 and she lost it. And there was a lot of guilt associated with that. And remarkably, that entered into every financial decision she made, losing that $5. She was terrified. And what do we do? Money makes big promises control, promises hope, promises satisfaction. Those are lies. Only Jesus Christ can give that. And helping people see that money is a tool to get them towards their goals. And that's what we want to do, get everything moving in the same direction. Investments, estate planning, retirement planning, insurance, all those things pushing in the same direction. Just a quick word on investments. Tell you that our biggest job as a money manager is just walking people through a market cycle and just holding their hand. God's created a reality we live in where the market expands and contracts, and you can follow economic cycles way, way back. It's the way God set up the world. He told Noah, until I return, there'll be springtime, harvest, summer, winter, heat and cold. And that's the way he set up the world and how it'll continue until he returns. And so a big job is holding people, keeping diversified. So we invest in broadly diversified portfolios. There's over 12,000 publicly traded companies in 44 countries all over the world. And we want to get people working for you all over the world with investments. Solomon said to divide your portion to seven or even to eight, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. So, so in the realm of financial counsel, we've developed and refined a process, we call it Steps for Stewards, that just help people put the financial pieces into place. And there's a psychological aspect to investing. I'm going to skip ahead a slide here. Usually when people come to see us, they want to know, where should I invest and when? And those are good questions, but they're the wrong questions to start with. The questions to start with is, what are we trying to accomplish and why? And so we've had this thing, it's called the planning horizon. And before you can get to what you need to do, you need a trip below the horizon. What are you trying to do? Having $1 million portfolio isn't a goal. I want to be on the mission field in 10 years, or I want to get out of consumer debt, or I want to start a business in 2022. Those are goals. And so the first thing we do is just identify what we're up against. Identify what you want to do and identify where you're at financially. Identifying the problems leads to clarity. Clarity of what I'm trying to do. Once you have clarity of what you're trying to do, you can start thinking about solutions. And as a financial planner, what do? You really have three levers on your desk. If it doesn't work, what you want to do when your assets are less than that, you can save more today, which would be pulling back on your current lifestyle, or you can push your goal back. I'm not going to start a business in 2022. It's going to be 2032. And the last lever on your desktop is take more risk with investments to get a higher return. And kind of those three levers are the big levers financial planners have to make it work. Once you start thinking about solutions and what can work, that leads to decisions. What am I trying? This is how we're going to make it work. Once you have decisions, then you can start to implement the decisions. Sounds like a silly step, but it's remarkable. I had a guy in my office 3 days ago, and he's been sitting in cash for the last 10 years. He's afraid to invest. And it's because he hasn't asked what he's trying to accomplish and why. And if he did, he'd realize he'll never get there staying in cash. So implementing solutions. And implementing solution leads to results. And how do we think about that? Why is it helpful if your portfolio drops by 20%? How do you think about that? And how do I want people to think about that? I want them to think about that in relation to their goals, what they're trying to accomplish. So, and lastly, that's what we're doing. We want to manage the results. And I said one of our biggest jobs as money managers is holding people's hand through a market cycle, and that's just what we do. We tell them if you jump out now, your probability of reaching your goal is pretty much nil. And managing those results and viewing results in that context leads to confidence. So we call that the planning horizon. All right. One last thing I'm going to touch on, and that is a topic that leads leaders of the free world to tremble. So, and I don't think our president has ever heard of this before, and Congress refuses to even think about it, and the word is budgeting. It's a scary term for most people. And I got a slide on it. Budgeting. Why is budgeting important? Luke 16:11 says, if you've not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust true riches to you? What are true riches in this context? If unrighteous wealth is the assets of this world, true riches are things you can't see. They're things to enjoy in the next life. And Luke 16 would tell us that there is a correlation between how we spend our money and our ability to enjoy the things of the Lord. The Bible says, as you probably know, more about money. Jesus talks more about money than he does heaven and hell. It's not because money's the main point of every passage, but it's because money enters into every decision you make. It enters into every facet of life. And if we are spending someone else's money, and we are, it's the Lord's, every spending decision is a spiritual decision. And that's why just about every successfully financial couple, one of them does the dirty work of tracking expenses. And how do you do that? It's really no secret. People often call me and want a model budget they can start. And if you've ever tried that, you know it doesn't work. The only way you can start with a budget is track your expenses for at least 3 months. And once you find out where your money's going, then you can go to these averages and see, wow, I spend a lot compared to the averages on housing, or I spend a lot on going out to eat. And then you can start to make adjustments. So there's lots of tools available to help you with that. One is just paper and pencil, and I didn't bring any today, but there's just some people are very successful at just using a paper and pencil and tracking their expenses and adding it up. We have a 93-year-old, and she still does it very successfully, tracks all her expenses on paper and pencil. There's some great online tools. We have a financial portal that can help people track their expenses. There's also some great online tools, one called Envelopes. It's M and then Velopes. It's free. It's great. It really uses the old-fashioned envelope system where, you know how grandma would have envelopes or things, and she would put some in the grocery envelope and some in the clothing envelope, and she would spend out of it. That's what Envelopes does. You go through and you're paid every 2 weeks, and you put money in the envelopes, and as you spend money out of the envelope shrinks. And when your wife asks you, do we have money to go out to eat, you look in that envelope, and you can decide if it's Red Lobster or it's McDonald's or it's a ham sandwich at home. I'd encourage each of you to track your expenses. And if you do it, just to wrap up with a word of caution, when you add up your expenses and you look and see what's coming in for income, undoubtedly your expenses will exceed your income. I remember when I did it the first time, when Beth and I first got married, I was 25 and I did just that, tracked my expenses for 3 months and saw what was coming in. And I remember when I finished, I yelled over my shoulder to Beth and said, "Sweetheart, we're going to have to move back in with my mom and dad." I was joking, but I decided if we're going to starve to death, we're going to do it with gusto. And so we started just giving money to the Lord's work right off the top. And the Lord has always taken care of us. So the point I wanted to tell about that, when that happens, when expenses exceed income, call out to the Lord. Call out to the Lord. I know the easy thing for me as a husband when it didn't work was to get frustrated, because when it didn't work, I heard my wife saying, "You're a bad provider." And the easy thing to do is to get frustrated. And the right thing to do is to call out to the Lord. And it is remarkable how often we come to the Lord with two options, A and B, and the Lord provides when you start praying a third option that you hadn't even thought of. So call out to the Lord. So budgeting. I said one final word already, but I'm going to say one more. The other thing to keep in mind, whether it's financial planning or budgeting, is, because I don't know where any of you are at, if you're in a place of abundance or you're living paycheck to paycheck or you're over your head in consumer debt, but your job is to be faithful, and it's God's job to be a provider. So no matter where you're at, if you're in the place of abundance or you're overwhelmed and you got Chase calling you five times a day yelling at you for stuff you're not paying, your job is to be faithful. And if you've done something wrong, repent. And if you're spending too much on credit cards, stop it and cut them up and start being faithful. Call out to the Lord and look to Him to provide. People end up with health problems, have breakdowns because they're taking on more responsibility than they need to. And that is thinking their arm of the flesh needs to be the provider. It's the Lord's job. He's promised to provide. It's our job to be faithful. And that's what we want to encourage. We want to encourage you guys to be faithful and keep calling out to the Lord. So I have got like a 5-minute video to show. If I can have 5 more minutes. And then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. The video, I have to tell you, I wrote the script for the video. And the first time I listened to it, I just about doubled over on the floor laughing, because there's all these pretty important guys we got from all over the country, and to hear them repeating my words was kind of a gut buster.
In 1925, a diphtheria epidemic broke out in Nome, Alaska. Serum was desperately needed to treat the illness. However, the city was completely icebound, ruling out transportation by sea or air, and leaving more than 1,400 people in peril for their lives.
An epic journey called the Great Race of Mercy was organized, involving 20 mushers and 150 sled dogs. The sleds carried the needed medicine on behalf of the U.S. Public Health Service across 674 miles of some of the most inhospitable terrain.
Thankfully, not one of the sled drivers decided to take refuge from the bitter cold or to surrender to the elements. The gravity of the task required unflinching commitment.
Each one recognized that his time, his calling, and most importantly, the serum he carried was not his own. In a word, the sled drivers were stewards.
1 Corinthians 4:2 tells us, "It is required in stewards that one be found faithful." A steward is someone who is entrusted with something that is not his or her own.
As a human being, and a Christian specifically, you and I are overseeing God's resources on our journey through this world. We are stewards.
The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. David's words in Psalm 24 go well beyond our physical possessions, our bank accounts or brokerage accounts. our homes or cars.
Everything we have, our being, our lives, it all belongs to Him. This means our time and talent as well. We want to use it all to glorify Him.
The U.S. Public Health Service did not give us this stewardship. No, for Christians, the stakes are much higher. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 10 says, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ.
The sober reality is that one day we will all give an account to the living God for how we use our resources.
The hope of every believer is to hear from the Lord the words, well done, good and faithful servant. This approval will be a certainty for those who make the supremacy of Christ evident in every area of life, including finances.
Believers Stewardship Services, or BSS, exists to help Christians in their stewardship responsibilities.
BSS has the necessary technical knowledge, including planned giving expertise, investment acumen, and understanding of the tax and regulatory landscape.
More importantly, BSS also has the Christ-honoring perspective to support you as a steward. That is helping you change the way you think about your assets. BSS is a not-for-profit organization. Therefore, most services are provided free of charge or at a significantly reduced cost.
BSS can assist you with estate planning. If you have never done any estate planning, you are not alone. More than half of all adults in the United States do not have a last will and testament.
Completing a will is only one step in putting your estate in order. Advanced medical directives, health care proxies, and a power of attorney document are also items to consider. A well-thought-out estate plan can save your family tremendous heartache and unnecessary costs.
BSS can also assist you with planned giving. People often wish they could give more to the Lord's work. By structuring a planned gift, Christians can have a greater impact than they thought possible on the ministries they love.
A customized giving strategy can bring about tax savings and positively impact your income. These savings say nothing of the profound difference that can be realized by the work you are supporting.
If you've never heard of a donor-advised fund, a charitable remainder trust, or a charitable gift annuity, BSS can explain how these tools may be of use.
BSS is a registered investment advisor. Where appropriate, BSS offers investment counseling. The ministry helps individuals and institutions by identifying financial goals and determining a suitable mix of investments to attain them.
BSS has no products to sell and can sit on your side of the table when offering objective and prudent investment advice.
BSS also offers financial planning services. The staff leads select believers through a program that articulates their financial and spiritual goals and propels them towards fulfilling their dreams.
BSS refers to this process as finding your place in His story, in God's story.
In many ways, the work BSS does supports local fellowships of Christians and related ministries.
It supports the work of ECS Ministries.
It supports the work of Pittsboro Christian Village and other Assembly senior living communities.
It supports Bible camps such as Camp Lilolai.
It supports Emmaus Bible College.
And the work of CMML.
And so many other works of the Lord at home and abroad.
Every time a Christian saves for the future, gives away assets, or spends money, no matter the amount, it really is a spiritual decision.
The Scripture does not advise or recommend that stewards be faithful. It is required of us.
Whether you have many assets or just a few, whether you're a corporate CEO or a dog sled driver, you want your day before the judgment seat of Christ to be one of no regrets.
I lived down south in South